It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Your freedom came at too high a price.
The mission was compromised. The same person who set me up then has just set me up again. So I'm going after him. Got your attention.
Tell me what you know of James Bond.
He'll light the fuse on any explosive situation.
Show me the diamonds.
Don't blow it all at once.
What happened to you?
Bond.
And be a danger to himself and others.
I'm going to let him mix things up a little.
My friends call me Jinx.
My friends call me James Bond.
Wow, now there's a mouthful.
Who sent you?
Your mama.
Glad you could make it, Mr. Bond.
I see you don't chase dreams, you live them.
One of the virtues of never sleeping, I have to live my dreams.
Time to draw the line.
Well, it seems you've become useful again.
Maybe it's time you let me get on with my job. So, this is where they keep the old relics, then, eh?
Twist so, voila!
You know, you're cleverer than you look.
Better than looking cleverer than you are.
James, be careful.
A nice palace can be such a treacherous place.
I take it Mr. Bond's been explaining his Big Bang theory.
Yeah, I think I got the thrust of it.
Must you touch everything?
Would you like to show me more?
Kill him.
Now! 1,000 meters and closing.
Put you back into it, eh? Let's get down to business.
Looks like we're going down together.
Not yet!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined by what is available of my James Bond crew. We're a little bit shorthanded today, but there's still five of us here ready to talk about Pierce Brosnan's last stand as Bond. You know, my ever-faithful sidekick is Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is really a pleasure to be here today.
And it's a pleasure to have you, Kimo Sabe. And we also have with us Mr. Brian Hughes.
It's really a pleasure to just be sitting down.
I know that feeling. Mr. Scott Gardner.
It's a pleasure to be anywhere these days. So, yeah,
and Mr. Jeffrey Vaughn.
I think it's a pleasure to not be doing business right now.
Yeah, you know what? That's what I've found over the years that I've been doing this. This is a great diversion from life. So I may keep doing this until I no longer have that, but we'll see.
Seems very reasonable, Paul.
Today we are talking about the last venture of Pierce Brosnan as James Bond, the movie Die Another Day. And I'll throw out to you that I saw this on the opening day, actually in a matinee showing, and that is significant because I saw this before the internet was able to tell me that I wasn't supposed to like it. So I didn't know I wasn't supposed to like it, and I actually had fun watching this movie. I thought this. I walked out of this thing. I smiled through most of it. It is very different, and we'll get into why, than other James Bond movies in some ways, but it totally fit that cartoony violence feel that I wanted to see at that time. And it had a lot of just moments that made me smile. I'll leave it at that, and we'll get more into it as we go on. I know I saw it at least twice in the theater before home video, and I've seen it several times on home video. So I am probably the anti-internet on this one, because the internet keeps saying I should hate this movie. So let's work our way around. Sean, when did you see this?
So like you, I saw it in the theater opening night. It was, and I went with a crew. I have a crew of friends who diehard Bond fans. These are people who, I don't know if you guys remember the DVD releases of Bond. It took a while to get Bond on DVD. So this is a crew that, like, we were at Borders Bookstore when the release, or Best Buy's, you know, at the time, I think it was Best Buy, at the, whatever, wherever you could get DVDs, we were there trying to seek out the releases.
Tuesdays at Best Buy, man, absolutely.
Yep. Yep. So we went as a crew. We wanted to get them right when they were coming out, and then immediately started watching. So that's the crew I was with. I vividly remember this one because it was one of the first times we walked out that it was so divisive. So when you mentioned that we were doing this one, I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. Because you just naturally see that people could be in a different place with it. I had a lot of fun with this film, but I vividly remember our conversations walking out of this movie. And I think even if we're in agreement in certain areas of this film, it may be we liked different things or didn't like different things. And this one, I think, is going to be an intriguing conversation. So I'm really glad to be here today.
Okay. So, Brian, what do you say?
Well, I saw it when it came out, and I had actually had an experience with it a couple weeks before, because this was the movie that taught me about the falsehoods of the internet. Because in 97, I was heavily into IMDb and just cruising every single page I could, trivia on everything, anything. And there was a page for Die Another Day, and there was user reviews already for the movie. And there was, of course, still that when they still had their discussion pages, making this out to be the best movie and the worst movie ever made, hundreds of reviews already in there on it when nobody had actually seen it. So I was like, okay, this is divisive. But I went with my group of friends, and we all locked out with that same kind of, yeah, it was a James Bond movie. No different than the Connerys or the Roger Moores. You know, it was one of those. It wasn't the greatest. It wasn't the worst.
All right.
And that's kind of how I felt. It was one of those in the middle.
What do you say, Scott?
So I'm going to be the newbie on this one because, you know, as I've said in every one of the Pierce Brosnan Bonds that, you know, your reviews that I've been a part of, you know, I hadn't ever, these were the ones I skipped. I had, you know, I consider myself a huge James Bond fan, but I just could never stand Pierce Brosnan. So when he got cast as Bond, that's where I bowed out, and I didn't come back until Daniel Craig came in. So I had never, well, with the exception of GoldenEye, which I can't remember if I even saw it in its completion or not, but I had seen at least portions of GoldenEye at one point. But beyond that, I'd never seen these. But as I've been watching them, as you know, we've been doing these reviews. Come the second one, I was kind of, you know, my opinion was turned around. So, you know, I was kind of more into these, and I really enjoyed the second one, and particularly the third one. But this one, and you kind of stole my thunder a little bit on this, Paul, but, you know, as you said, you know, the internet had tried to condition me that I was supposed to really hate this movie, that it totally sucks, that there's no redeeming qualities, blah, blah, blah. And so, although I had been really looking forward to it, and in a couple of cases actually watched forward after our reviews, on the next one in the series. This one I didn't watch until I absolutely had to watch it for this review, which was, as we record this, it's a Thursday night. I watched this Tuesday night, was my very first time watching it. And, not to bury the lead, but basically, once again, I don't know what the hell the internet's problem was, because I found myself, as Brian said, it's a Bond movie, and it basically gave me everything I both expect and enjoy in a Bond movie. So I don't get it. All the hate and all the ugliness that I've seen on it, because it kind of falls right in that spot for me. I mean, yeah, it's cartoonier, I guess, in some aspects, or maybe a little hokier than some of the other Bonds. But I mean, I grew up with Roger Moore as James Bond. I mean, so I'm kind of conditioned to that, and that might not necessarily be the Bond I want every time, but when I get it, it doesn't seem weird to me, you know? So yeah, I dug it for the most part, and we can get into specifics, more as we get into this.
Did we lose Jeff?
Yeah, it looks like he.
Oh.
Yep.
Uh-oh.
It was just like it was just 2 seconds ago.
Yeah.
And he said, "Fuck that guy."
These guys don't hate this movie. I'm out of here. While we wait for Jeff to come back, I would just say, I kind of agree with what you just said, because as I was watching it for the sake of reviewing it, as opposed to when I just watched it for enjoyment in the past years, I started thinking it had a real feel like the Roger Moore movies did. It was definitely a little bit more cartoony. It was a little bit less gritty, but it was fun. And that's all, that's all I needed. I've liked the fact that the Bond franchise has allowed us to have different types of movies over the years. With Moore, we did have the more cartoony stuff. Then we had Dalton come in and give us a more gritty Bond. Then we went back with Brosnan. We kind of jumped all over the place. I felt like we had some gritty, we had some cartoony, but this one was more like the Roger Moore era. So that kind of sat well with me. And Jeff has been able to get back on with us. So Jeff, what was your first experience with this wonderful piece of cinema?
Yeah, at least the first 3 minutes. I think I saw it opening night. World Is Not Enough was the first one after Spy Who Loved Me that I didn't see at the theaters on opening day. I saw World Is Not Enough the second day.
Slacker.
I think that the problem with this film is it telegraphed one thing and went the exact opposite direction. I don't mind cartoony, and I don't mind serious. I prefer serious. I like Casino Royale. But if you look at the pre-credit sequence in this film, it is Bond at his toughest. It is in a dire situation. It is pulling no punches. It is all that. And then the rest of it is cartoony. It's disjointed. It very much doesn't work with the two things together, and again I'm not opposed to either. While my preference is serious, I can absolutely handle the if we go off of the official series and into Never Say Never Again, the way that Bond handled some of the villainy and the violence in that was humorous. I have no problem with that. There's also the lingering thing that this film can't get away from, whether you like it or not. They were not committed to Bond in this movie. They were trying to make Jinx into her own spinoff series, and that took away from the thing. And I say this as somebody who likes Halle Berry. I remember my brother saying he never wished he was an M&M so much in his life as the swimming pool commercial where she's swimming at the M&M. And I'm hard pressed to argue with him. But the fact is that it was not only cartoony, it was not a great performance from Brosnan, who I really like. Brian's and my late friend Kevin and I were watching The Fourth Protocol, And he came out of that movie really pissed off that Pierce Brosnan wasn't Bond. And so I remember that very vividly. You guys have probably even heard me say that I regret that Brosnan never got a script of the caliber of Casino Royale.
That's funny.
These are all big things to me, and it's unfair to hold them against one film, but this thing to me has a lot of strikes. Again, I can rationally discuss it scene by scene, not get worked up. But to me, this is an abysmal Bond film, saved only by the fact that it's not The World Is Not Enough.
Well, see, I mean, I will disagree with you in that I don't think it's abysmal at all. In fact, like I said, I enjoyed it. I walked out of the movies. I remember being asked, like, the following day, you know, what did you think, by somebody else who was a Bond fan? And I said, go see it. You're going to enjoy it. I liked, and again, we can go in more detail as we go along. I liked the fact that the movie was, that they tried to make a big deal. I think it was the 25th film, whatever it was. It was an anniversary film, and they tried to make a big deal out of that. So they had callbacks to all the previous Bond movies in it. And even the Halle Berry stuff. I'm sorry?
I loved that.
Yeah. The Halle Berry stuff, I loved that they did, you know, the callback to Ursula Andress with her. I thought that was just awesome. And while they did focus on her more than you would a normal Bond woman, I didn't feel that she overshadowed Brosnan. In fact, you know, there was the point at the end where he had to save her life. So, you know, I felt like, you know, he maintained his own heroic stature in it.
I'm not even vaguely bothered by her apparent competency. That's never an issue. I mean, you know, Barbara Bach to me and Michelle Yeoh are phenomenal Bond girls, and they're both extremely competent. I don't care if Bond gets rescued by one of them or anything else like that. I've got a question for you guys, and this is a legit question. This is not me knowing the answer. One of the few novels. I read all of the Fleming and all the Gardner novels and a couple since then, but not with any regularity. Did anybody read Colonel Sun?
No.
By Robert Markham or Kingsley Amis as it was billed?
No.
I'm told that was the first post-Fleming Bond novel. Okay. I'm told that there are elements of Colonel Sun in this movie. I don't know enough to say that. That's one of my few weak areas of Bond knowledge. I hate that I can say that.
Well, if you're going to read anything,
I feel like Dave Pastorella might know the answer to that, but unfortunately couldn't join us tonight because he's the Bond novel guy, right?
He definitely has. Well, I think he and Jeff are both the Bond novel guys. I think they both actually. Brian has some Brian has some novel knowledge as well.
The novels aren't empty. I've read several of them. I've listened to the rest, but I haven't gone beyond Gardner, except for Mike Grell's Permission to Die, which is the best Bond non-Fleming story I've seen.
That's a great one.
Yes.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah, I you know, the Bond novels are a point where I don't have a great deal of knowledge. My knowledge mostly is the films. And I have the James Bond companion at home, so you know I've got.
It's always neat when you see something interlaced from the novels, without going too far ahead into Casino Royale again. The minute I saw the opening credits sequence, I knew that they were doing the British dust jacket from the hardcover.
So now
the first printing.
The opening sequence. I've actually heard criticism of the fact that the water skiers at the beginning, or the surfers rather, you know, first of all, that it's obviously not Brosnan, which to me doesn't really bother me that much because I lived through the Roger Moore era. And then, you know, that's the start of CGI in the movie and that this movie is too heavily reliant on CGI. But again, that didn't bother me at all. I'm not sure why that bothers people, except when it looks really fake. And
you guys know by now that I'm really critical of this stuff, and it didn't bother me either.
Yeah, if it looks really fake and it takes you out of the movie, I'm totally with you. I understand it.
Yeah.
But if it, you know, I didn't think it looked, you know, I thought the music combined with the you know, the visual of the three surfers, you know, one, then two, then three, I thought it was really, really cool. I enjoyed that build up there. And then the whole, you know, the whole scene at the beginning, which is one of, you know, one of the ones where the scene directly relates to what's going on in the film. I thought there was some good stuff there when they show you that they know he's a spy and you know, they're playing along. And, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in that opening scene.
I go crazy every time someone's like, oh, he's James Bond, a super spy. It just kicks me out of the movie whenever something like that happens. Happened in, what was a View to a Kill?
The most blatant one was Diamonds Are Forever when Jill St. John says, you just killed James Bond.
Like the famous super spy. That and then the Bouncing Bettys. Because they had the Bouncing Betty landmines.
Oh.
Yeah, they're in the DMZ, and they've never used Bouncing Betty. So those are all anti-personnel mines. You step on them, they blow.
I thought it was cool to have the, you know, the those hovercrafts coming in that, you know, wouldn't put any pressure on them. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, that was cool, and MythBusters actually tested that and said that would work.
Oh, okay, because that was kind of a bridge too far for me. So it's interesting that, okay, I was wrong.
See, as a general rule, I could, you know, maybe you guys feel differently, but as a general rule, I don't need Mythbusters on James Bond because I don't try to recreate anything he does.
Really?
Well, the only thing I ever tried to recreate, I got slapped repeatedly in the face for. Yeah.
That I could see.
After I did my rewatch of this, I started listening to the commentary track with Brosnan, which for the opening sequence in particular is pretty intriguing to hear how they put this together, because he jokingly says it was him on the surfboard coming in, but then clarifies, you know, what actually went into that. And one of the pieces I thought he pointed out is, like, these guys are wearing goggles when they're coming in and doing this piece. And he said that was legit. They were, you know, they were doing that at that point in time. He said everything was very weather dependent, and they had to get these shots in on very specific days, hoping that the weather would allow for the beautiful sequence that it was opening through. That opening sequence was shot in, I think he said, five or six different locations.
None of which were Korea.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But they ended up splicing together in such a way that it made it feel like they were the same location.
Oh, I love stuff like that when it gets pulled off correctly.
Yes.
If you look at Dark Knight Rises, the chase at the end of the movie, I because I'm familiar with all three locations, I sit there going New York, Pittsburgh, New York, Pittsburgh, 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 Chicago, Chicago, Pittsburgh, New York. And like even on side streets, I'm looking at Pittsburgh, and I was just there with where our nephew was looking at University of Pittsburgh, and I was like, this is that scene, you know.
That's cool. That is definitely cool when you recognize the actual scene, you know, place, locations. The problem I have that I ran into at this point was that once that opening sequence that I thought was really cool ends, we get what I consider to be the worst Bond song ever.
Yes.
And I've heard people praise.
All right. Can I call it the worst one we've reviewed so far? I'll absolutely agree with that, because if we jump ahead to Spectre, I think, you know.
What was the song for Spectre?
Is that the Sam Smith one? Is that the one?
Who the hell is Sam Smith?
Is that the?
It was so bad you wondered what photos he had of people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not sure I dislike that more than this one, but we'll go with that, because when we get to Spectre, we'll discuss that one. I didn't really care for the fact that they showed the torture scenes during it, and you know, I'm very fond of the Bond openings where, you know, you see the girls jumping on the trampolines and whatever. I didn't need to have the title sequence be part of the movie. But, you know, just the same, the torture does lend itself to the story.
Yeah, it does. And I accept that they use giant scorpions, which Indiana Jones taught us that those don't really have a whole lot of bite in their venom. You got to use the small ones if you really want to have some sting. And I double check that that's actually true.
By the way, you wonder if the torturers maybe didn't see Indiana Jones.
Maybe not.
So yeah. Always when people make bad decisions in movies, it's like they don't watch TV.
I liked that. I don't know about your point, Paul, about it being part of the opener or, you know, part of the credit sequence. I get that. But I liked the whole torture thing and him looking, you know, just really beat up and bedraggled and everything, because that lent into something. And I'm not sure what it is in my brain that likes these kind of things. But, you know, one of my other favorite Bonds is License to Kill, because he's very much like Indiana Jones by the end of that movie, where he's been through the absolute ringer by the end of that movie. And so I like that when James Bond, you know, takes some abuse, you know, because that was one of the things that always used to drive me a little crazy with the Roger Moore movies, is that, you know, he'd go through all this stuff, but then he was still spotless at the end of the movie with a perfectly pressed tuxedo on. And I'm like, no, you know, grit.
With the exception of the stairway scene in For Your Eyes Only, where he runs up and stands in front of the car and the car swerves to the edge of the cliff and he kicks it off because he's clearly channeling Connery. I absolutely agree with that, Scott. That's why I like this. And there's also, it's also a little bit of a throwback to, and I'm going to confuse the two books because the books happen in the opposite order of the movies. I think it's You Only Live Twice, where he gets captured and brainwashed by the Russians and comes back and tries to kill M. And basically gets sent on a suicide mission to redeem himself. And the fact that Bond is not only a flawed character, but fallible. So I wouldn't have minded a little bit more of that. But again, this goes to what I was saying. It doesn't fit with the other elements of the movie. That's grippingly serious.
Right.
And this becomes like, oh, we've created this thing so it can blow up. You know,
there were things I didn't understand about this. And that was why they had to make it 14 months. Why didn't they make it 2 months? Because there were no lasting effects from it. I mean, he gets out, gets a shave and a haircut, and all of a sudden, you know, he's 007 again.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
And the thing is, like, you know, if he'd been in their captivity for 14 months and they'd, you know, done all the torture and everything, he would have lost a few pounds. He would have been skin and bones, you know, just horrible shape. But, you know, it's the movie.
But realism wasn't too high on their priority list, and I'm okay with that.
True, true.
So, okay, there's one thing about this. Nobody that is in captivity that long didn't talk. You know? Bond can be peak human. He can't be superhuman.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say the 14 months is just too long. It should have been a shorter bit of time, because everything that happened, the discussions that he had with the general, the colonel, whatever, the guy's father, looks like it happened 5 minutes after the first conversation when they thought he'd died. And so, I mean, again, all that aside, I found this section of the movie to be very captivating in what it meant for James Bond. And then, of course, they put him on the bridge, which we've seen enough movies going back to, say, White Knights and other movies that we know, oh, this is a trade-off, and he's about to go free, but he thinks he's going to get shot in the back. And I'm like, James Bond thinks he's going to get shot in the back? Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
I like and dislike the 14 months for a lot of the reasons that are stated here. So I like the 14 months because of the fact that it sets up the stage of why would they think Bond talked? So, which is a premise that is brought up later on. You've got M, who at this point, this Bond You know, especially if we're supposed to believe that this still is the same Bond from the Roger Moore and the Connery era and Dalton and so on, which is kind of how these films have been going all along, because this one does have quite a few homages to, especially when we get into the Q sequences with getting mm-hmm. the and stuff, which I really liked those. But if we're supposed to believe this is all that same continuity, at this point for M to be questioning whether or not he has cracked and those things happened, the time frame works for that. It doesn't work for every reason that was stated here, so I agree with that. The opening sequence, I'm torn on that too, because I don't love the torture being there, but I liked it there because I don't know that I want to see that amount of time of Bond being tortured. I'm ready to move on. I want to see more action, things like that. It needed to be in this film because of where the story goes.
Yeah,
I did think that opening sequence had a beautiful sequence that I want to make sure before we move on for it, I reference, because it was something to me that stood out and I thought was striking. It was when Bond is hunched over. It's the later part of the torture sequence where he's in his cell and there's the girl who like looks like she's inflamed that walks up to him and almost is soothing him. You have this bit where it's clear this guy's been through a lot and there's something to soothe him from. I thought it was striking. I thought it was beautiful. And I thought it added to the theme of this guy's being beat up bad. When visually we as the viewer, to everyone's point here, he hasn't lost the weight. They're clearly feeding him well. But it adds that sense of, at least in your mind, they are trying to, this guy's being beat up. And I thought that sometimes it's effective in a film to put in those things that are making you suspend your disbelief. Because Bond's over the top. I mean, there's going to be some Bond films. Obviously, we're right. I mean, there's different flavors of Bond. And this is one of the more over the top flavor Bonds. Which I like the variety in my Bond films, but we'll keep going off of that piece. But that scene was beautiful, and I think it was very, very fitting for what was going on at the time. If you're going to do this in the credits,
Sean, I think your point's really well taken, man. I absolutely agree about that particular visual, and I think that. You know, I am a sucker for changing it up. I like all the standard Derek Mattings opening sequences and all that. That was one of the things you looked forward to. But I also liked For Your Eyes Only, where we saw Sheena Easton singing the theme. And like I just mentioned, the Casino Royale, knowing that we were going back to the beginning, that they literally used the hearts animation in that they use is straight off the British dust jacket from the first edition. And as a fan of the novels, and a collector, I immediately knew that, and that did something for me too. But this thing, I think the point you really made, which is, I think some of us, may have been you. Sorry, I'm losing it. About it being, you don't want to see the torture scene going on real long during the movie. But it happening is integral to the story.
I don't disagree with that perspective on it, but I don't think you had to go too deeply into the torture scene. I don't think you had to show too much. I kind of loved, and this goes to the cartoony nature of the violence and what I'm looking for, but I kind of love the fact that as soon as 14 months of torture is done, he's like recovered almost immediately. I got a big kick out of the scene when he's at the hotel and he, you know, he smashes the mirror and the guy's like, yeah, Bond, we're not going to, and he just turns around and says, I don't really give a shit. And he's, you know, like, he's not even interested in the, you know, their whatever it is, their Korean mob or whatever it is they have going on. So I had fun with that right off the bat. And then I thought the sequence where, you know, he starts taking over again and he goes to Cuba and he's, you know, investigating all the stuff there. I thought all of that stuff was great. I really enjoyed it.
I'll disagree with you slightly. He is interested in that mob because he leveraged it. He did use their intent, like they had a common enemy here. And because he wasn't getting the support of the British government, he had to use them to get what he needed to get where he needed to go. So he did use that.
Yes.
In that sequence.
Yes. No, you're right about that. But, you know, he basically said, I don't care about, like, trying to shut you down, is where I was going with that.
Right. No, you're 100% correct on that. I was just the one twist I did like that he leveraged it as a way to get where he was going. So I wasn't really disagreeing with you. I did say I was slightly disagreeing with you. It's more of the I didn't want us to end with like that we didn't do anything with him, because I actually thought that part was kind of cool.
You know, the scene in Cuba made me want to smoke a Delicado. You know, I'm used to just, you know, your run of the mill cigars. I don't get to have these fine Cuban aged cigars like Bond does. But I thought that whole, again, the whole sequence, you know, basically, you know, it was like an old file that he just kind of like reopened so that he could get some information there and have a contact there, which brings him to the facility, which is not the most believable thing in the world, where they just turn you from a Korean national to a British national in three easy steps. But they can't remove diamonds from one guy's face. So, you know, it's not totally believable, but it's kind of over-the-top Bond science fiction stuff, which, again, I get a kick out of.
But what you just said, Paul, is this is where I run into problems with so many different things. Not the external worldly logic, but the story's own internal logic. They can do all that stuff to people, but they can't get the diamonds out of the guy's face.
Don't hate me for this, but diamonds are forever.
Thank you. I told you guys I was going to like this discussion.
No.
I think you wanted the scars removed. I think you wanted the diamonds to stay.
Yeah. Well, they did.
Well, I'm trying, you know, whenever I come across something like that, and Jeff, as a writer, I think you got to do this, is I just apply my own internal logic to it. And I say, okay, if I'm writing the story, this is how I'm explaining that away. And then I just accept that logic. So in my mind, somehow, if they remove the diamonds, it's going to cause some sort of poison to be released or an artery to open or whatever. And he kind of likes the look that he looks more threatening with it. So he went with it.
So, okay, if you're going to do that, and that does happen in stories, there's a great explanation of how they're smoking in space and Thank You for Smoking. And the guy in Rob Lowe's character even is just spitting out ideas about, oh, you know, thank goodness for the such and such device. And but the Hollywood phrase is hanging a lantern on it. You have to do something to say, hey, here's why this works. And because, in other words, like I said, in other words, you're defeating the story's own internal logic. Forget about the world outside. But when a story starts collapsing on itself, this is where my willing suspension of disbelief is challenged.
I understand that. And it's one of the things, more as a comic book reader, but as a moviegoer as well, is I agree with you. You know, you set your own internal parameters. These are the superpowers the guy has. These are the weaknesses he has. And then you have to live with them. You can't just pull out the Deus Ex Machina and all of a sudden say, oh, he had this power that we didn't know about until right now, and now he's using it to solve the mystery. You know,
much like your bat shark repellent in your utility belt.
Well, if it's being done for comedy purposes, I'm all for it. So I have no problem with that.
My usual version of this is the comic character Spawn. He's an assassin. He dies. He makes a deal with the devil. He comes back. He's a good guy. Okay.
Well, Ghost Rider made a deal with the devil and is a good guy too. So I think that ends up being kind
of
true.
Because see, Ghost Rider reneged on the deal.
That's true. So
well, the Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider. I truthfully don't know about the later ones.
Yeah, Daniel Ketch, but I don't know.
Yeah, either. Daniel Ketch. Yeah.
And we're going far afield here.
We are. Next thing you know, we'll be talking about glow-in-the-dark covers.
let's save that one for another day. We'll put a pin in that one. So then, you know, in Cuba, we get the introduction of Halle Berry as Jinx. And again, I love the Ursula Andress homage there.
Was that the first reference? Because that's where I realized they were doing it is with that one. But is that the first one in the movie?
Certainly the first one I caught.
Okay.
I don't.
By a woman. Daniel Craig does it later. and Austin Powers too, but you know,
references to the previous movies because there's Easter egg seeds throughout this movie of references to prior films.
According to, and I didn't realize this going in, I read it later, but according to, and I'm pretty sure it's Wikipedia, I read this, that there is a reference to every prior Bond in this movie, supposedly. I caught several of them, but is there really a reference to
really that really seems like a stretch to me. And I would now have to rewatch that again with that in mind.
Yeah.
Cause this is what? Number 20, right? This is the 20th movie.
I thought this
was
right.
Yes. Yeah, the 20th. So the 40th anniversary.
19 other references in this movie, to the other. I don't know that I buy that. Maybe I'm just,
I.
But it's on the internet. It must be true.
Yeah, I hate to be a person who just accepts internet things, but I'm thinking it is true. But I probably would be lazy and just look to see if I could find an internet article where they give you the references to each Easter egg.
It's on IMDb in the trivia section. I see it right here.
Most of them are in the scene with Q.
They mention it.
I think I'm pretty sure, because you have the Thunderball jetpack, you have Rosa Klebb's shoe.
That scene was where I realized that the what's her name, Ursula Andress,
mm-hmm.
is that the woman's mm-hmm. name? That's where I realized that was intentional, because when Halle Berry walks out of the water wearing that, I thought that's from another Bond film, and I just kind of filed it in the back of my brain. But then later in the Q scene, as you say, with the shoe and the jetpack, I'm like, oh, they're intentionally homaging. Okay, now I get it, kind of thing. But it wasn't until reading that article later that I realized that supposedly, again, that they were doing it intentionally because this was, I think, 40th anniversary of Bond. And supposedly they referenced every prior movie, but I certainly didn't catch 19 other references. So.
Well, there was actually more, because they did the Thunderball with the jetpack,
mm-hmm.
and then a very subtle one where, as Bond is going out of the medical center, he's grabbing the grapes, which is just like they did in Thunderball.
Some of them are small. Okay, I gotcha.
And then there's other bits of trivia that are just so bizarre, like the book on ornithology that Jinx or that they had there in Cuba, that was written by James Bond, the guy that Ian Fleming named the character after.
That's funny.
My uncle always had a copy of that book.
Well, wasn't Bond disguising himself or whatever as an ornithologist in on Her Majesty's Secret Service? Am I remembering
right?
Yeah,
I think you're right.
What did he disguise him as in this one when he first met Jinx, too? Didn't he say that?
Yeah, I think so.
All right,
yeah.
I'm going to go through them quickly because I just found an article where they give them to you. So Dr. No, the homage is the bathing suit. From Russia with Love, the homage is the Rosa Klebb shoe. From Goldfinger, it's a little bit more subtle. It's the laser that they're going after Jinx with. From Thunderball, we have the jetpack. You Only Live Twice. This one I think is a little weak. They have that Bond disguised himself as a Japanese man. In this, we have a Korean man going as an Englishman. On Her Majesty's Secret Service...
he wrote the acronym on the CD on Money Penny's desk.
Yes. So then where are we next? Diamonds Are Forever.
I thought they replaced Pierce Brosnan in one scene.
There are a few references to Sean Connery's final film, Diamonds Are Forever, but I will go with this one. Bond reads an article about Gustav Graves that uses the line Diamonds Are Forever. Live and Let Die, he uses his Walter PPK. And what is it? He does another Bond film. In that film, for the first time, he uses a Smith & Wesson Model 29, which he uses in the, he uses a Smith & Wesson in this movie. Again, that's a little bit of a push. There's the belly button jewel in The Man with the Golden Gun, and he does that with the diamond in Jinx's belly button. Spy Who Loved Me, there's the parachute with the British flag on it.
Union Jack.
Yes. Moonraker, there's a swordplay scene. For your Eyes Only, there's a yellow diver's helmet that Bond used, and it's in Q's workshop. Octopussy. There's a scene where he goes in a mechanical alligator, and that's on the wall in Q's workshop.
Wow.
As well as the mini jet.
A View to a Kill, there's also some sort of electronic snooper that's in Q's lab. So Q's lab has got the most of them.
Well, let's agree that if Bond had slept with Madonna, they were throwing something towards Grace Jones back in A View to a Kill. Because that would have been just as gross.
Living Daylights. There's a cargo hold in a jeep with, Bond and his love interest Kara Milovi escape from a plane through a cargo hold in a jeep before the plane explodes. License to Kill. Timothy Dalton is suspected of being a traitor and tells him the same thing. There is the going rogue.
He goes rogue, and which is what I liked. Yeah.
GoldenEye, there's the watch with the laser in it. Tomorrow Never Dies, there's a remote control for the car. The World Is Not Enough, there's a geodesic dome. And then we're up to Die Another Day. So there is something, but some of them seem to be kind of stretching your credulity.
Some of them are much, much clearer than others.
Yes. Yeah. But I still get a kick out of the fact that they did it, that they felt that there was something to be done there. And they didn't. I like Easter eggs where they don't necessarily beat you over the head with them. They're there. If you recognize them and get a kick out of them, that's great. If you don't know what it is, it shouldn't stop the movie for you.
They're not speed bumps.
Yeah.
Right. If you notice, every one of the cars that Zhao had in his collection were all Bond cars, ones that were used in the movies.
So there's a lot of references. But again, I think your terminology there works for me. I don't think any of them really served as a speed bump. I don't think there were any of them there where if this was the first Bond movie you were ever seeing, I don't think there was any of them there that made you say, wait a minute, why are they doing this?
Right.
So now, one of the biggest criticisms I've seen of the movie, so we might as well go on that, and I thought it was cool, but one of the biggest criticisms is the invisible car. People said, you know, that that's pushing it too far, and that it was just a bridge too far for a lot of people. Now, but my understanding is they actually have that technology the way they described it, where you could put the cameras on one side and have a projector so that it creates the illusion of invisibility. Now,
I've seen this, and it's nowhere near the level of perfect that it is in the Bond film.
Well,
how it's supposed to work, yeah.
But just
you can tell there's something there. It's just, you know.
Just the fact that there's a theoretical version of it, that's good enough for me, because I want Bond to be far out there and have gadgets that, you know, make you say, wow.
I think that's a very fair observation, Paul. If you go back to what we now call jet skis, the wet bike was invented for Spy Who Loved Me. And that exists because of Bond movies. There's all sorts of stuff that exists because of Star Trek and things like that. I'm totally fine with that. I just hated the scene.
Well, the thing about the car that they kind of pushed a little bit is, okay, it could be invisible, you don't see it, but that doesn't do anything to mask the sound of it crunching the snow as he's driving in it. But they made it almost seem like a stealth car that you know, you wouldn't even know if he drove up next to you in it.
I wonder if this is one of those things where, you know, time will be kinder to it as, you know, in the real world and in other movies, we get closer to that kind of technology, because I wasn't aware of that criticism of the film. And I didn't really think it was that far-fetched. And I wonder if maybe part of that is we had that in Spider-Man Homecoming, where they had the plane that had the same thing, and it could go into like a camouflage stealth mode, basically using the same sort of technology.
Yeah.
And so having seen that in another film and kind of buying it, I guess, it didn't seem that far out to me. And it didn't seem either that it was completely perfect, because now I'm not sure if they were doing it because they were showing you like it's not perfect, or if they were showing you the outline of it, kind of like what they do with Wonder Woman's invisible jet in the comics, so that you know where it is. Like they're letting the reader kind of see it, even though to everybody else, you know, it's perfectly invisible. So I don't know if it was artistic license or not, but I noticed it had that kind of like, you know, the cloaked bird of prey look to it, where it wasn't quite perfect. Like if you caught it at the right angle, you'd see some distortion. You'd see something. I kind of wonder if they were going for that.
Or the Predator camouflage.
Yeah. Same type of thing. Yeah.
There were flaws to it, and I actually liked that part of it. I actually think you're onto something though, as far as saying, I think what you're saying, I think it's a little bit of A and a little bit of B. I think they were, as the viewer, allowing us to kind of see it, like the Wonder Woman invisible jet thing. So I think that thing was there too. But I think you were also supposed to believe this is exactly what it was. Tech that was beyond what we have currently available, even though there is some backing to it, you know, at least in a principle concept. I liked when it was discovered. First of all, I liked the driving. When they were hiding it, they did very minimal driving. And it was always very slow driving in that process. I agree, Paul, like we hear a little bit more than what we were hearing with it. So there's some truth to that piece. But we're already at this point established that this movie's not afraid to go over the top. So, you know, that was kind of becoming what Jeff was saying, you know, as far as if you're going to talk about, like, is this a serious movie or is it going the more over the top end? But when the guy bumped into it, and now we got Diamond Face noticing that it's there. I like that he was looking for the thermal end of it, and that it's not perfect. There's ways to discover this vehicle's there if you did. Once the shooting starts on the vehicle, its integrity is now starting to be compromised, and that technology's not fully working perfectly. You know, it's not like invincible tech. I actually liked that there was some flaws in it. Just so that way, you know, in the film, there was actually, because if it was perfect, we wouldn't have had any sense of danger during the car fight scene with the missiles and things like that. And I thought the way that he was constantly striving to get that tech back up and running again to utilize it, I actually thought the car battle scene between the two of them was pretty exciting in what it was doing. You know, I like the over-the-top Bond car scenes when they're done a certain way and you've got a tete-a-tete between him and a villain. I like that the villain was competent, you know, where it wasn't Bond just like totally wiping out the villain. I liked that he was a good driver and he had gadgets of his own, and it was Bond's missiles trying to stop him. And it was really right up until the end, the two of them were kind of neck and neck. So some of that stuff was really working for me with that piece. And I sometimes, when they do gadgets, Brosnan and Roger Moore would agree with the criticism about the vehicle. Because I was looking at IMDb's trivia sequence. Roger Moore's very critical about the over-the-top gadgets, which fascinates me. Because when I look back, when I think of Roger Moore's movies, I'm like, isn't that like Gadget Central? I mean, as a kid growing up, that was kind of the what Bond was during that era. But and Brosnan actually wanted this film to be darker and more grounded, in which it kind of starts off that way, but kind of went the other direction. So Brosnan would agree with the criticism for it too. But I liked the car sequence, and I liked that before it was discovered, when the stealth mode was on, that vehicle was driven very slow. And I think to build the sense of, okay, he can sneak in with this because of some of those pieces. I agree, though, that in that ice, I don't care how slow you're going. You got that weight on that ice. Yeah, there's going to be a whole lot more noise than what we heard in the film.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
And there was no slide whistle. I'm always thankful for it. But I think you hit on a couple things there. Pierce Brosnan for, you know, the World Is Not Enough and this one, he was very critical of both movies, saying how they just kept trying to go for bigger and badder and crazier gadgets and all that, and he wanted it to be more down to earth and grittier and darker. But I think he was a little too vocal in the press, and I think that's part of why the movies got shellacked back then. Here we are, you know, 22, 23 years removed, and you can actually look at it with different eyes and see it, you know, for what it is, I think. And it's not as bad as it's made out to be. I mean, it's not, you know, like it's not going to be in anybody's top five, I don't think, but Bond movies altogether. But it, you know, it's not a bad movie.
Yeah,
it's in my bottom two. But Sean, I gotta say, you've given me pause about that car scene, because what you said about it not being perfect is true, and that is a point worth considering. I think I still hate it, but I do have to. That does give me a pause.
What's interesting about this film, there's a couple of trivia pieces that I thought were interesting, because we were talking so much about Bond not looking like emaciated when he came out. He was hurt, though. He actually got hurt during this filming of this film. He got a very famous leg. It actually stopped production. It was the first time that ever happened with a Bond film. But Halle Berry was, too. There was a smoke grenade, like, from one of the sequences.
Hell yeah.
That hit her eye, and she had to have like a 30-minute operation to remove it. Mm-hmm. And for the way these films get more and more over the top, in the commentary scene, Brosnan was referencing his adoration for the stunt crew in this, because this film was one where he was looking back over some of these people who he's worked with now for multiple films and the quality of the stunt people. And I get why he would say that, because yeah, they were doing, I mean, if he got hurt and she got hurt doing it, imagine what this was like for even trained stunt people, the more and more over the top that these films got.
Really good point.
Did he get hurt during the sword fight? Brosnan, I would assume that would be where
it was the opening sequence.
Oh, okay.
So during the opening sequence, when he's running around from vehicle to vehicle, there's actually a point in time where he's getting on the hovercraft, and it was the way he was bounding onto it, because he had his kid on the set for that sequence, and the kid was far more interested in meeting one of the other people on the set than he was watching his dad do the sequence, which was totally fascinating. But Brosnan keeps mentioning, like, this is the spot where it happened. And he tweaked his knee. And in such a way, you know, we all know what it's like. You step the wrong way, you do something the wrong way in any part of your body. It just goes the wrong way and something explodes all of a sudden. It was something that stuck with him throughout the whole thing. It did make me remember one other thing, though, that was a common theme throughout the film. He did have some injuries post the torture, and it was really his ribs that it kept coming up more than anything else. That was, I think, from that whole sequence, if I remember correctly, that he was favoring, I think, throughout the rest of the film. Not enough to really equate to 14 months, but the man was hurt during the film as a character. I should say that wasn't his real life injury, but
yeah. And I would have to say the star that they were paying attention to is probably Rick Yoon, who was in Fast and Furious the year before. So that makes sense.
So now, I guess one of the point worth discussing is the, once again, having a double O agent turn and be a traitor. Oh, we lost Jeff again. So hopefully he'll be back. So, you know, with Rosamund Pike as the, what was her name? Frost?
Yeah, Miranda Frost.
And then she, you know,
and this is,
she's a turncoat.
Yeah, this is kind of an indictment on M, because it's all of M's people that are, you know, you had the one in The World Is Not Enough, and we've got another one coming down the road.
We also had what's his name, Alec in GoldenEye.
Alec Trevelyan. Yeah, but you couldn't say that M handpicked them, whereas she did handpick Miranda Frost, and she was the godmother of Sophie Marceau's character, and never once for a moment suspected her.
Yeah. So,
does she remind anybody else of Sharon Carter from the Captain America?
Very
films?
Much so. I thought it was the same actress for a while.
And she was only 23 when she did this. You know, she was pretty young. It was like her first big role.
It was.
Yeah. But to me, she looked like she was 30 still. She looked more mature than her age. But I didn't like her from the beginning, so I knew she was a bad guy.
Yeah, I thought that they did not really try to hide the fact that she was going to double cross him. And I also don't think they tried to hide that that Gustav Graves was, you know, really, what was it, Tan Sun Moon. I think those, they didn't come out and say them, but I also don't think they tried to hide them, right, you know, all that much. I think they were right laying it out there for the viewer to see in the performances, you know, what the situation is with them. Were there any performances in this movie that you thought stood out? And I'll start off by just saying the one performance that I could have done without in the movie at all was Madonna. Much like her theme song, yeah. I could have done without her character in it. Now, what I heard was that she insisted that as part of her part, that her character sleeps with Bond. And Pierce Brosnan said, uh-uh, that ain't happening. And somehow she's continued to be in the movie.
I was wondering at the beginning, was Toby Stevens, you know, Gustav Graves, was he trying to be Hugh Grant at first? Because that's the buzz I got off of him at the beginning when they first introduced him. Hugh Grant trying to be William Shatner. You know.
That I'm not sure about.
He's very Hugh Grant, now that you pointed out.
Yeah, yeah. I see that. I could also see a little bit of the William Shatner over the top performance, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if any of that was conscious or if it's just the way it played out.
That's really funny. I think for me, the Madonna thing is just it's the word I used earlier, atrocious.
One of the characters that I enjoyed that they threw in here, just to give like the alternate point of view and. You know, it's funny because as an American to want to say, oh, shut up to this guy. But I really liked Michael Madsen, the way he was so dismissive of Bond and everything and that went forward, you know, and that Jinx was his girl and that was it. You know, I thought, you know, I guess obviously if they had done the spinoff movie, he would have been M to Jinx's Bond. But I liked the way his character was portrayed in it. You know, when Bond is walking in the beginning sequence when they're trading him, is look at him walking like he thinks he's some kind of hero. You know, I thought that was all really cool.
That makes a lot more sense. I was wondering all along why Joe Don Baker wasn't in there. You know, because he had been in the other Brosnan Bond movies. And so it makes sense that they're going to spin Jinx off. They need to, yeah, and that makes sense why they would have
him there. She would need a boss to report to, not another field operative. So that's a good observation.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen John Cleese as Q even more than we did. I just, love his delivery. His comic timing is just impeccable. And when he would respond to Bond or comment to Bond, it was just, you know, to me, it was great. And again, it goes to the cartoony nature of the movie because it's over the top funny. But I just really get a kick out of him.
I like him much better now. Like, watching it back now. And the reason why is I loved Desmond Llewellyn as
Q. Oh, no question.
When I, the first time I saw this, it wasn't that I hated him as it. It was I missed Desmond Llewellyn. I think over the years, I think I've gotten used to the fact that this is the first one without him. And I, this time around, it was, I appreciated him, John Cleese, more in this one. But I remember that was one of the things, if you're going to ask me, well, first time you saw it, what was one of your criticisms? He wasn't Desmond Llewellyn. Can't be, but it was. I
get that. I truthfully, I had the same reaction to, you know, finding somebody to not be Bernard Lee.
Right.
You know, I get it.
I have too much affection for John Cleese that it didn't bother me. And of course, they threw in that was a flesh wound.
Yes.
As a little nod to Monty Python there.
I got to share a brief, very brief story. I have a creative partner who I meet in New York City on a pretty regular basis on Saturday mornings. And we have, you know, breakfast or brunch, whatever. And we're sitting in the window of this restaurant and Cleese walks by. And I am to this day disappointed it was not a silly walk. It's so freaking disheartening. I they have not invented the unit of measurement for it. I know it's totally unreasonable and irrational. I don't care.
Nor should you. So, I guess we should comment on the score. And Scott, you're a score expert. What do you think?
Well, first off, I want to go back to the song. And I guess I'm just not that observant, or, well, she's not anybody that I keep up with to begin with, but I did not realize that the fence, I guess she's supposed to be his fencing instructor, whatever. I did not realize that that was Madonna at all. I just completely did not recognize her, but Madonna's never been of any interest to me at all anyway. So I don't know. Do I get a pass for not recognizing
her? I'm not going to hold that one against you.
Yeah, I did not catch that, but the song was absolutely shit. I couldn't stand the song. I was like, really? This is a James Bond movie theme? It's like, it was terrible. The score, I've been listening to it. I got the album. I've been listening to it. I'm torn because I really like David Arnold. I think I've raved about him in every review so far about how much I really like David Arnold, and I do. I thought the score worked fine while I was watching the movie. It didn't take me out. I don't know that it particularly enhanced anything for me either, but I mean, it was a serviceable score as an album. I don't know. Maybe it'll grow on me with time, but it seemed very, it reminded me a lot of, shit, what's the guy's name? Marvin Hamlisch?
Really?
That did, you know, the Bond 77. What movie was that?
Spy Love Me.
Yeah, it just that jazzy, like very of its time score for that movie. This kind of reminded me of that a lot too, because it kind of was like trying to do a kind of a jazzier rock and rolly type of, just, you know, the use of instruments in a lot of instances. Now it was not like a traditional symphonic score. There was a lot of guitar stuff, a lot of just, I don't know what they were going for. Some of it worked and a lot of it didn't necessarily, but again, maybe it'll grow on me with time, but I suspect it was just Arnold trying to do something different, because it's gotta be tough. You know, when you're doing a series of movies, to be faithful, to make it work, to give the audience what they came for, but at the same rate, not just constantly repeat yourself. I think that's why somebody like John Williams is, you know, such a master, where he could do a movie and you know, create an iconic score for like Jaws, and then turn around and do Jaws 2, which is essentially the same damn movie all over again, and have a completely different score that was also awesome. And he did that with like the Indiana Jones scores. Yeah, the Indiana Jones themes would repeat, but they are completely unique scores, all of them, except the last one.
Scott, I'm gonna have to disagree with you a little bit here, and not I'm not giving any credit to him on this, but I think the thing you have to realize, I mean, if you look at the work, the body of work that he's done, especially the work he did in Casino Royale and the earlier movies, the earlier Bond movies, he was capable of that kind of range. I think he was limited more by production. I think the producers, the director, everything was scaled back and said, we're going to make this a Bond film. It's his last one. Let's stick with what we know. Because the transitional music all sounded like your standard Bond music. The fight music sounded like your standard Bond music. They didn't let him branch out.
But I agree.
I think you guys are both onto something. And that's this. Scott, you're absolutely right. When you're watching the movie, it doesn't break you out of it. So right. That's the first job of a soundtrack.
Absolutely.
Is don't insult the mood of the movie. That's even more important than capturing the mood, is don't insult the mood.
Right.
But Brian's also right. It seems like a lot of paint by numbers stuff, in addition to David Arnold's natural talent wanting to try something different in there, hitting up against those things, I think. And the result is not pleasing. It is not one that I can listen to on its own in more than passing. And that starts with me hating the song. I mean, it is the worst song up to this point, and it's one of the two worst ever.
Well, the Madonna song's pretty critical for all this, because one of the things the Bond films does, and I think all the best Bond films do it, they take that theme song and blend it in into the score. And this film does that. I mean, subtly sometimes, and other times right smack in your face, as well as pulling in classic themes. But he did that with this. I mean, and, you know, that's part of it. So it's very... I think when you compare it to some of the best Bond scores, the opening theme in so many of them are timeless. And what I mean by that is actually what Scott was saying before, where some of them, yes, they're indicative of their period, but you want to hear current artists, contemporary artists, do a take on it, and makes you reminiscent for the original, but yet you appreciate the attempt to play around with it. And you love it when that theme reoccurs subtly and organically throughout the film. If you don't like the theme, especially this one's very stuck in its period. You know,
I think you're making a great point there about them how they lace the themes through there. You can go back to Live and Let Die and George Martin doing McCartney's theme a little too heavily. Through it, and yet there's other points where in this series where this has been done really, really successfully, and I think the comparison goes harsh on David Arnold here because he's done it successfully before.
Yes,
right.
And so just the same as we don't like all the Bond films uniformly, even though we love the Bond films, right? We don't like them uniformly. We don't like all of David Arnold's works uniformly because of that. I mean, John Williams may be an exception to this rule because you can really like a lot of his stuff. But I think that you guys have really sort of collectively really stumbled onto it here. But I will say, I don't think you can listen to this soundtrack a whole lot. It's just not that pleasing. A
couple of points that I wanted to hit on. One, I don't think that they had decided that this was Brosnan's last movie when they were making this. In fact, I understand that they had been in negotiations to make another Bond film with him. So I don't think that they had any kind of
like a deliberate swan song.
Yeah, I don't think they were doing that.
Okay.
And then, Jeff, I guess your mileage can vary because I actually love the way that George Martin worked in McCartney's theme throughout Live and Let Die.
Oh, I just think, listen, I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. It was just, if I would say, if I was the producer, I would scale it back 20%.
And I would have left it as it was.
More like what John Barry did with A View to a Kill, because it was prevailing through it, but it wasn't overbearing.
One of the things there that really stuck with me was when you listen to Brosnan on the commentary track, he talks about his love, and this commentary track was clearly done shortly after the film was made. So he almost alludes to the fact like that there's going to be another one, you know, just in the way that he's talking it through. He doesn't say that, but it clearly isn't somebody saying goodbye to the franchise. But he was comparing himself to the other Bonds, and in the sense of fondly looking back at his fond memories of Sean Connery and Roger Moore, and looking at the franchise, saying that with each of the Bonds, you can pick, you know, if you can pick at least one that is like a pinnacle of a Bond movie that people want to go back and say this was the best. And he was, you know, mentioning things like Goldfinger, for example, and stuff like that. He said, you're hoping as a Bond that he said, I'm hoping one of my films is a Goldfinger out of the batch. And he said, they're not all created equal when you go through them all. But he said, you know, hopefully they're all fun. They're all enjoyable. But he said, you're hoping for that one that is going to be that thing. And I thought it was an interesting way to look back at each of the eras and what an actor who's taken over the role would hope for. But the thing I loved about it, and I was giddy about it, was just cool listening to a guy who was playing Bond. Whether he was selling it because of the fact that he was doing the commentary track or not, the fondness seemed genuine for the franchise and not just his era, but the history beforehand that came.
I am really refreshed to hear you say that, because I have not heard this commentary, but I have heard him speak previously about Bond, and it was not the actor saying what he needed to say to get the role, to please the role, to do the PR for the film, that kind of stuff like that. He talked about being a kid seeing Connery.
Yeah.
And I think that always came across as legit. And so it's encouraging to hear you describe it in similar terms.
I would listen to the commentary track, whether here's the problem. You don't love the film. You don't want to watch the commentary track.
That's actually, I find a way to get through things that I either didn't like originally. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, if you watch Kenneth Johnson's commentary on the original V miniseries.
Oh yeah.
It's freaking phenomenal. And he talks about all the shortcuts that were forced on him. And as a writer now, I really gravitate to the realities of that. I mean, and it's just so great. He even gives his AOL address at the end of it. I mean, it was a great commentary. And I was not a fan of the original. I am now, because I understand what he went through to do it. So, yeah, I actually enjoy commentaries, intelligent commentaries, I should say, on films that I don't necessarily like.
I thought in this particular movie, of the Brosnan movies, the one thing I can say where I thought was better than the others is... it appeared to me that this was the one where he was most comfortable in the role of James Bond. I thought his acting in this one actually was better than it was in the other movies. And I think he's a fine actor. You know, it's not like I look at the other ones and say he sucked or anything like that. But I just felt like he grew into the role a little bit and just really just seemed to be, like I said, comfortable with it. So that was a big plus for me.
Well, that's a nice point. I don't think I agree about this one, but it is, I mean, genuinely a very nice point to make, and it goes with the observation of that Sean was making about his commentary and things like that. I think the guy genuinely loved doing the role, which, you know, is a contrast with Daniel Craig at the end, is clearly contemptuous and doing it for the money. I think that that's a really nice thing to say about this. And I think going back, I like the unease in GoldenEye because I think the character had something to prove. So I always felt that was the unease in the relationship with the new M and all that kind of stuff. I liked it for that. But that's one of my favorite Bond films. So, you know,
that's his Goldfinger.
Those are real good observations. Like I said, at the outset of this, I was really looking forward to all the difference of opinions. I haven't changed my mind at all. But you guys have given me a bunch of different perspectives that next time I watch it, you know, in 20 years, that I'll be, I'll be looking for. Though I gotta confess, I'll probably do
it. Are we gonna do it as a Jaws reunion in 20 years?
I'll probably do the commentary track fairly soon.
I honestly think that Pierce Brosnan had a sit down with Daniel Craig before he took on the role, and he tells him after each movie, say you'll never do another one again. You hate the role. That way they'll pay you so much more money for it. And then the other thing is, if you guys haven't been paying attention to the stories lately, especially with all the news on Amazon getting control of Bond, that Pierce Brosnan has said he's more than willing to come back for an old man Bond movie.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
You know what? We should do a show just about speculation, because the fact that Christopher Nolan wants to do a Bond movie.
I kind of think that, you know, we have, what is it, five Daniel Craig movies to do. And then if we get to the point where, hey, we've done all the Bond movies in this retrospective, then maybe we'll do a speculation one. But for the time being, we still have movies to cover.
They just got it. We need to have a speculation show now while the iron is, you know, strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah, I'm afraid of that speculation.
People are talking about this right now.
As far as the directing in this movie goes, I'm not particularly familiar with Lee Tamahori. I thought he did a competent job overall. The one thing that he did that I did not like was the speed ramping, where he would, you know, speed up time and have, you know, like those fast motion scenes to show the passage of time. I felt like that was lazy directing, frankly. But otherwise, I thought he was fine.
If you do that in a stylistic montage, you can get away with it, and it can be brilliant. But when the thing is, when we talk about the internal logic of stories, there's also an internal logic to this series. And that's something we haven't seen before. And if you're doing something we haven't seen before, unfortunately, it ramps up the pressure on you for it to work. And it didn't work here. Yeah. I appreciated the fact that I've used the phrase paint by numbers about other stuff in this movie. I appreciate trying something. It didn't work.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And you could tip your hat for the effort. But
absolutely.
That's as far as it goes.
I was trying to take my mind back, you know, to 2002 to try to figure out where that was coming from, if that was emulating some trope of the day, like some other successful film had been doing that or something. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. But every time it happened in this, I was like, what? I was baffled by it. And it happened a lot in this, I noticed. Weird camera stuff, weird speed ups and stuff, and you know that time dilation stuff. And I'm like, well, what are they trying to go for with that? I didn't quite get it.
Yeah, I didn't appreciate
some of them
that either.
Really odd.
Before we give our ratings, is there any other points you guys want to make?
I had a couple.
Go ahead, take the stage.
As I said, I really enjoyed the movie a lot. Honestly, the only thing I really didn't get from it was Halle Berry. I mean, yeah, she's fine to look at. And I get that this was supposed to be some sort of backdoor pilot for her or whatever. But to me, this was like, you know, this was like, say, like a Superman movie where suddenly Wonder Woman shows up and half the movie concentrates on Wonder Woman. If the movie's titled Superman and Wonder Woman, then I don't mind. But when it's Superman and she comes in and steals half the movie, then I mind. And that kind of happened with this. This was like, this is James Bond. This is not James Bond and Jinx or whatever the hell her name was.
Or Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. So there was that. I would have been a lot more forgiving if she'd have asked at some point if we knew what happened to a toad that's been struck by lightning, but that never happened. So I was kind of disappointed. I'm sorry. She was much better in this than anything else I'd ever seen her in, but she's a pretty face with not a lot of going on behind it. So, I loved the settings, especially the ice palace, ice hotel thing at the end. I guess that's a real place, but I just thought it was really neat. Even if it wasn't a real place, I thought it was pretty cool. You know, just a novel concept, and
it took.
I like the whole look of it.
The ice palace. I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off. The ice palace took them 6 months to construct, so it was something constructed actually for.
And apparently,
this.
There were such. Places, maybe not as elaborate as that, but there were such places in existence in that era.
Oh, okay. See, I thought they went to the real place and filmed it there, you know, or you know, at least portions of it. Obviously not, you know, blowing it up or whatever, but
they did do like a quarter of the film in Iceland, but it was like the stunt crews and things like that went there. None of the main cast actually did.
Right.
It was this ice palace that they were using for it was actually a construct because of that. So, yes, you're right. And it kind of goes with what Brosnan was saying in the commentary, that there were sequences that were shot in different locations that were glued together. This was an example of one of those.
Right. I thought it was neat. I thought it was kind of novel. And the scene where they're first driving up on it. Just the look of it with the geodesic dome and all that. And it reminded me a lot. And I can never remember the name of the place, but there was some Russian like experimental city that they built in, I don't know, like Siberia or somewhere. That was like a scientific retreat or, you know, like a scientific like testing house type of thing. I can never remember the name of it. And this gave me that vibe. It looked a lot, you know, very similar to it and all with the, you know, being out in the ice and all that. And I just thought that was kind of neat. It was different. I really liked the car stuff in this. The hovercraft stuff was kind of fun and kind of interesting, but it also, seemed a little hokey to me. But the car stuff I really liked, although I kept one. I wish that they had explained the bad guy's Bond car, because, you know, Bond having the gadget car is a given. The bad guy having a gadget car just kind of came out of nowhere. And I did notice that there was a point where both of them had their missiles deployed and were firing at each other. But then there's a part in the chase where the bad guy has Bond dead to rights. And turns this missile thing off and you know, you see it come back up and then they just go back to fighting as they had been doing previously. He could have killed him right in that moment with the missiles, but turns it off. And I was like, what? And then lastly, I don't really want to end on a negative, but this is a negative, was the janky effects. There's a lot of janky effects in this, but you know, it also kind of lent into the period for me. I don't quite forgive it because some of them, I think, even though this is now a 23-year-old movie and everything, even at the time, I think the effects probably looked pretty janky compared to other stuff that was coming out. But that was hard to determine because, you know, I was thinking, you know, what was another like really effects laden movie around the same time, and you had Attack of the Clones, which is essentially CGI from start to finish. But a lot of that stuff's looking a little janky these days too, if you're honest about it. So I don't know, but there's some really dodgy CGI, but I also noticed a lot of green screen stuff that just doesn't work. When Bond and the bad guy are fighting on top of the hovercraft in the opening sequence, there's some of the green screen stuff there that's really dodgy looking. But you know, you go back to some of the older Bond films. You know, what's the one where he's fighting one of the bad guys on an out of control boat, and the visual out the window is just ridiculous. You know the one I'm talking about? I can't remember which film it is.
Thunderball, when it's the hydrofoil.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, the stuff out the, you know, happening out the window is
they're
just
trying, again, you're going with the speeding it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, otherwise I dug it. I thought it was a lot of fun. This one was, you know, Bond films kind of fall for me in one of two categories. They're either ones where I feel like, okay, I got to make sure I'm fully awake and I'm really paying attention. I'm really following this because it's going to move fast. And, you know, I want to make sure I'm keeping up with, you know, all of the, well, I would say the first three of the Craig movies are like that for me. Like, I've got to really be paying attention what's going on and I want to follow it and all that. And then there's ones that are just kind of like popcorn movies, and I can just like turn my brain off and let it take me where it wants to take me. Maybe walk away at the end going, I don't know what the hell that was about, but I had fun. This falls into that second category for me, because after about the third scene change in it, I'm like, I don't know what the hell is going on in this movie. I'm just going to have fun and watch James Bond blow shit up. And that's pretty much what it gave me, I felt like.
You mentioned two things that I wanted to touch on. We were talking about the car. Actually, this piece is, it's more of an aside than anything else. The cars, they had to retrofit with four-wheel drive because of the way that they were shooting those sequences. So both cars are not four-wheel drive vehicles, but they had to make them work that way in order to pull off the stunts. But you had said, why did they have that car there at all? Gustav Graves kind of explains that. He modeled his life after Bond. He was living his, the over-the-top things that he was doing, the way he would enter into places. He was, his whole American or, you know, British, whatever persona over-the-top was meant to be a modeling himself on some level completely after James Bond. So the reason why he had the car was probably the same thing. Now, that they didn't say that about the car. But he made it a point to talk about, even like his entrance when he came with a parachute and stuff like that, was all him maybe in many ways parodying the guy that set him on this pathway at all with what happened. So I'm not saying you have to agree with that explanation. I'm just saying that's kind of how I always took it, because when he's having his villain spiel with Bond, he references the fact that I'm this way because of you.
Something just occurred to me, Paul. That list that you read of the Easter eggs. Where did you get that?
I just did a quick Google search. Die Another Day Easter eggs, and that came up.
I got you. I just realized there's one that they missed.
Oh.
So when Bond turns the camouflage back on again and deploys the spikes out of the tires to back the car up to avoid the other car running into it, that those spikes and that shot of the spikes coming out of the tires is exactly the same as in Living Daylights.
Yeah.
That just occurred to me. Yeah. That's all I got.
All right.
Did anybody think that the palace looked a little bit like the Theatre of Australia?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Sydney Opera House? Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that. I made that connection also.
I'll say this because I think it bears saying that there were several pieces throughout the movie, you know, action pieces and whatnot. The fight that Bond and him have at the swords, and then everything that went on inside that palace. Which, by the way, at the very beginning, when he goes in there, you see someone going around serving drinks on rollerblades. Did any of y'all catch that?
No.
No. But the thing is, with the action pieces that were going on, we're not really talking about those. We're talking about all the other stuff, all the, you know, just it's a Bond movie, I'm going to watch it and all that, but we're not talking about the sword fight and what went on in that sword fight and, you know, how it should have or shouldn't have worked. And the final explosive ending in that palace, that there was something on in there but it just kind of all was so, I think that's part of the reason why the movie, at least why it's not one of my favorites. Again, it's not one of the worst, but all that stuff is there, but there was no sense of danger.
But I thought that was because of the fun nature of the movie. And the sword fight was pretty brutal. I mean, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I thought the sword fight to me seemed like they went back to Never Say Never Again, where you had that kind of not so good video game fight between Largo and Bond. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, what can we do to make this a little, you know, to amp this up a little bit and make it, you know, an early battle between the hero and the main villain and, you know, see what we can do with it. It had that flavor to it, only better. And it did seem pretty brutal. You know, there is that trope, and I mentioned this talking about a comic the other day, where I don't like the fact that people can swing a giant sword at somebody and meanwhile just get a little tick of blood off their cheek. You know, it's like, you know, you should be decapitating him if you're doing that. So it's just too coincidental that it happens so frequently in movies and comics where somebody just gets a flesh wound all the time. But that taking that trope for what it's worth, I thought that the sword fight was really good, especially when they take the épées and they throw them on the ground and they pick up the real swords and say, let's go.
Yeah. And there was that one moment where Bond had a Scottish claymore and Graves had a samurai sword. And it was just like Connery and in Highlander.
See, I really liked the sword sequence because I was actually paying extra attention to that as it started. I wish I could remember what review it was and who was doing it, but there was a movie review I was listening to, you know, watching on YouTube a while back. I want to say it might have been talking about the sword fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan in Episode 3. It was drawing a comparison with something where it's like the critic was making a point like how ridiculously over choreographed this was to a point that it was unrealistic. And then he compared it to the sword fight in this. And he's like, if you want to see how this should have happened, how this should have been filmed, check this sword fight scene out with Bond. And I remember watching all that and then kind of forgetting about it. But as this started, that memory came back. I'm like, oh, this is going to be that sword fight that guy was talking about. I got to pay attention to this and see, you know, if I feel the same way. And definitely, I mean, this was a very visceral, brutal fight between the two of them that I felt like, okay, yeah, these guys are legitimately in danger. It wasn't ridiculously over choreographed like, you know, again, the sword fights in something like, you know, the Star Wars prequels or something where you never really felt like anybody was any danger of losing a hand or a head or something.
Something you said earlier, Scott, really stuck out with me. You mentioned popcorn flick, and you're referencing different kinds of Bond flicks. There's elements of this, and this happens with a number of Bond flicks, where they become like 80s action flicks.
Yeah.
The quips, the over-the-top action, sometimes where it gets, you know, beyond belief, and the focus is on being more and more over-the-top in the sequence of them. And certain things happen that defy logic. And then there's elements of silliness that go into that as well. I like 80s action flicks and what goes along with them, the popcorn flicks, and they scratch a different kind of itch. But it does happen in, if you look at different eras of the Bond flicks, there are the roller coaster that is what are Bond movies. These will happen with these. This has a lot of those elements in it. Which, if you don't like that in your Bond flicks, and you know when it starts to divert or it's inconsistent in the flick, I can see how this one, like I said, I went with a crew of mine that absolutely adore Bond movies, and we walked out and it was all over the place as far as analyzing this film, which was not a common experience with this crowd. And this conversation has more solidified with me why than it maybe did in 2002 even. This has been an intriguing conversation for me today, because I feel like I've learned much more about what maybe some reactions were to the film back in the day. I had fun with this one, but I get kind of the differences that people would experience with this film.
But
I'm trying to decide between two lines to sum up my feelings. One is, other than that, how did you enjoy the play, Mrs. Lincoln? And the other one is the title of one of Roger Ebert's books. I hated this movie. And Scott, Sean, I think what you were just saying backwards crystallizes it for me. It's, I actually do enjoy some of the more lighthearted Bond movies, but they have not, in this case, successfully fused the more serious ones, as we see with the torture and all that kind of stuff like that, with the final product. And I got to confess, Madonna and Dick Tracy, and I'm not a Madonna fan, Madonna and Dick Tracy was freaking great.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And like I said, I don't like her at all. And she was marvelous in that. So I know that I can be objective about it. She stunk on ice in this one. And it was the kind of what we talked about, like speed bumps on Easter eggs. Her appearance was a speed bump and it was just awful. There's so many good elements in this, just like all the films we go through. There's stuff that I end up reconsidering and being much more charitable toward, but this film as a whole, I can't. It's just, yeah.
Well, I guess this is a good point to give our ratings on the movie, since you, the way you led into that. I'm kind of leaning towards what Scott was talking about before, that sometimes there's a Bond movie where it's, you know, it's just kind of sit back and enjoy the ride. It's almost like a video game or like a, you know, an amusement park ride. I haven't changed my opinion since I first saw it. I walked out of the movie saying that this was fun. I enjoyed it. I recommended it to another Bond fan. I really can point to some negatives in the movie, but none of them really bother me. I mean, we've gone off on Madonna. She was really just inconsequential in this movie. You know, her part was, you know, unnecessary, and you could look at it and say, well, it's bad acting and whatever, but it didn't really affect my overall viewing pleasure. So, you know, if she had gotten her way and her character slept with Bond, it might have, because I think that would have been a bridge too far. But I enjoyed this movie very much when I watched it. This is probably, it is my second favorite of the Brosnan movies. I like GoldenEye the best, and then there's this one. You know, the other ones I vary in, you know, and you could listen to those episodes to see where I fell on them. But I'm pretty comfortable with my enjoyment of this movie. I did not have a problem with Halle Berry being in it, and I did see the backdoor pilot aspect of it, but I didn't feel she overshadowed Brosnan, and that's what the thing that would have made it a problem for me. So for me, it's a Jaws 2. I enjoyed this movie. And I know that is against the internet, but me and the internet have fought before.
I really struggled with where to place this one. I'm a huge fan of Pierce Brosnan. I love Remington Steele. I walked into this being really excited. I wanted to see him as Bond earlier, and that's not a knock on where Bond went without Brosnan. It was just, I was enjoying that show, and that when they announced that they were trying to court him for it, I was like, I want this. So I've always enjoyed, in all four movies, I enjoyed seeing him on screen as Bond, and agreed actually with the comment earlier that, like, he seemed to kind of grow into his own as Bond in this, which was something that I enjoyed seeing with him. This is not a perfect movie. I did like Halle Berry quite a bit. I wanted to see what they were going to do with the Jinx thing, whether or not it would have worked or not. That's something that it would have been nice to see what, like, a Jinx movie by herself without the Bond thing would have looked like. at the time because of the failures of like the Charlie's Angels sequel in Tomb Raider. They decided not to go that route. And I don't think it would have done very well because of the reasons that they thought it just kind of where cinema was at the time. But I would have been intrigued to see what a spinoff movie would have looked like, just because I never feel like I can get enough Bond, which is why I think when I grab him, this is not one that was a chore for me to watch. I wanted to watch this movie. I like the car chase. I like the sword fight scene. The CGI in it, at the time, I thought was some cutting edge attempt at trying to incorporate it. It didn't all work, though. And it's one of those movies where I'm left with where I'm at personally and how I would recommend it for somebody else. I would not say this should be a starting point, Pierce Brosnan Bond, for anybody. I think if you're already a fan of Pierce Brosnan's Bonds, this to me is, I'm actually pretty close to where Paul is, and this is my second favorite Pierce Brosnan one because it cooks and I really enjoy the action sequence. Had a lot of fun with it. It's a fun movie for me. Actually, when we did the previous movie, I watched this immediately afterwards because it just entertains me. So it's a popcorn flick, though. And when Scott said that, I'm like, oh my gosh, is he summing up where there's a distinction for me on different types of Bond films? So I enjoyed it from that aspect. This is a low Jaws 2 for me. And the reason why is, for me, it's endlessly rewatchable. I can keep watching it over and over again. But when if I'm going to recommend it to a Bond fan, because I was with a crew that actually one of my friends is very much in Jeff's place. He detests this movie. If you bring it up, it's like Jeff was contained compared to what he would have been. He would have been like throwing stuff while we were talking about this film. And that's not an experience I ever had with him. And he's very similar reasons in this piece. I recognize some of the flaws in the film for it not being for everybody. And that's why I pick it low Jaws too, because of the fact that I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. If you like the popcorn flick Bonds and the over the top and can recognize that sometimes a Bond movie can have flaws, this one's a flawed movie that's fun. And I would say low Jaws too, it's worth seeing for that end. And if you like Brosnan. So that's kind of where I'm at on this one.
Who's next?
I would give it a Jaws the Revenge. I think that if I was thinking, I was really trying to be serious about who I could recommend this movie to. And I thought that if I had a friend in hospice that had a choice between this and The World Is Not Enough, I could recommend this movie. that's about the full extent of it. I go into all of them wanting to love them. And I literally, I think I've told you guys this. I saw my first one was a double feature of Goldfinger and Dr. No at the drive-in with my parents when I was a toddler. From Spy Who Loved Me on, I've been going to the Bond movies with my friends or by myself. And then if I like them, I drag people to them. So I passionately love these films. And I love talking about the ones I hate. I have such fun with you guys. But all the great elements of this movie, and it does have some, they're all disjointedly barely connected. They're more connected to the other bad elements of the movie. That's it. A long-winded way of saying I hated it.
You know, you got me thinking about Sunday nights in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, brother.
Because like once every month on the Sunday night in the 70s.
ABC, man.
ABC ran a James Bond movie. You never know what you're going to get. You know, and it didn't matter. We all got around the TV set. We watched whatever they put on. And, you know, like if they put on Her Majesty's Secret Service, my dad would groan, you know. But I mean, the thing was, there was excitement. It's a James Bond movie. Didn't care which one really it was.
Yeah,
I didn't. And that's how I kind of feel about this one. This is one of those that you watch on Sunday night on ABC in the 70s. It just, you know, it ticks all the James Bond, you know, tropes. It gives you what it's supposed to deliver. That being said, out of the four, you know, Brosnan Bonds, it's my third favorite. GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, this, and then The World Is Not Enough. That's my order. And, you know, so I would have to give it a low Jaws 2, high Jaws 3. But it's, you know, still, all that being said, it's a Bond film, and it's right there in the middle with all the other middling Bond films. I don't see it, you know, at the bottom like some of the other ones. So that's just where I'm at.
Scott?
I would give this one, honestly, for me personally, I'm going to give it a high Jaws 2. I enjoyed it very much. I thought it had a lot of action in it. I mean, it gave me everything that that I really want out of a James Bond film. Again, you know, with that caveat of you know, there being basically two kinds of Bond films to me, and this falls into that category of just kind of just enjoy the ride. And I'd actually be interested to watch it again to see if I could differentiate, like, what was the point at which I realized I could do that with this movie? Because there's certain movies that, you know, right out of the gate, you'd know, man, you better be paying attention, because this one's going to lose you if you don't pay attention. And this one, very quickly into it, I realized, you know, I can just sit back with this one and let it take me on the ride, because it's going to give me everything I need to know. And I don't know where that trigger point was, but I'd be interested to know that. But, yeah, I mean, it ticked all the boxes. It had, you know, good, you know, cool gadgets, great car chases, you know, beautiful women, you know, all that fun stuff. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And of the Brosnan ones. Now, again, this is with a caveat of, you know, this was my first time watching all four of these, you know, where I really sat down and watched them. But just off the top of my head, I think this is probably my second favorite of the four Brosnans. I really dug this one.
All right. So that's it for the Brosnan era, unless he comes back onto Amazon. Next time out, we're going to be looking at Daniel Craig bringing us a very different feel for the James Bond franchise in Casino Royale. And I look forward to that. I'll tell you, I enjoyed the change, but I think it's going to be interesting for us to go through the hills and valleys of the Craig era, because I do think there is some... I definitely think there is some ups and downs that we're going to see. And it's,
there's some valleys like we fall off
and a cliff. It's going to be interesting to play with those a little bit. But next time out with this group, and hopefully we'll be able to get Dave and Chris back with us, you know,
that'd we're going to hit great. Casino Royale. Paul, I got to tell you, I'm so looking forward to that, because as negative as I've been about the last couple, you guys are going to think that something's happened to me. that's why I'm really looking forward to that, because then I flip it around and get really super critical again. So I so love what you guys bring to this discussion. Everybody's got different takes on it, and I really appreciate it, because I can get lost in Bond obscura really, really easily. And my wife is very kind and just sort of looks at me like, okay.
I think we probably all have similar experiences with our wives, because, you know, I don't know about basically anybody else's but my own, but I think my experience is very similar to yours, that, you know, my wife is fine watching a James Bond movie, but she just doesn't have the understanding of the James Bond love. So she's like, yeah, you know, it's like she pats me on the head and walks away. So
very much
with my wife, Bond ended with Connery.
Yeah, well, that was, yeah. I could get into that that mode myself sometimes, but I'm looking forward.
That was what it was like talking to my cousin, my cousin, who was about 7-8 years older than me. He'd be, Roger Moore is the saint.
And for some people, you know, Roger Moore got too silly. But then, you know, if you look at Diamonds Are Forever, you know, Connery was going pretty silly himself. But, you know, we're retreading ground here, and we've gone a little long on this one. So I'm going to say to our listeners, thank you very much for listening in. And this panel will be back. Bye-bye.
Give me the old firing range any day, quartermaster.
Yes, but it's called the future, so get used to it.
So, this is where they keep the old relics in, eh?
I'll have you know, this is where our most cutting-edge technology is developed.
Point taken.
Must you touch everything?
Does this still work?
Now look.
So where is this cutting-edge stuff?
I'm trying to get to it. Weapon, please. One pane, unbreakable glass, one standard issue ring finger. Twist so, voila. Ultra high frequency single digit sonic agitator unit.
You know, you're cleverer than you look.
Still better than looking cleverer than you are. Follow me, please. Now, new watch. This will be your 20th, I believe.
How time flies.
Yes, 4007, why don't you establish a record by actually returning this one? Your new transportation.
Maybe you've been down here too long.
The ultimate in British engineering.
You must be joking.
As I learned from my predecessor, Bond, I never joke about my work. Aston Martin call it the vanquish, we call it the vanish.
Oh, very good.
Adaptive camouflage, tiny cameras on all sides project the image they see onto a light-emitting polymer skin on the opposite side. You see, to the casual eye, it's as good as invisible. Plus all the usual refinements, ejector seat, torpedoes, target-seeking shotguns to shoot down mobile objects. Why don't you acquaint yourself with the manual? Should be able to shoot through that in a couple of hours.
Just took a few seconds, Q.
Wish I could make you vanish.